You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at seavillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at seavillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101, running from October 7 through November 18th. This six-part lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. On October 12, 2010, Susan Kern presented Tobacco, the First Cash Crop. Ms. Kern is a visiting assistant professor in William and Mary's Lyon G. Tyler Department of History. Throughout Virginia's early history, the powers that be attempted to diversify the state's economy, but tobacco, the evil weed, reigned supreme. Tobacco profits ensured that Virginia would flourish. Tobacco profits brought trade goods from England, paid local tithes and taxes, and purchased more land and more slaves for its further cultivation. This is the second in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Susan Kern. Thank you.
And I'm honored to say in all the reviews, the book is just starting to get, it's just out, that they are all mentioning how wonderful the maps are and how integral to the book they are. So I need to thank Rick for that. All right, we're here tonight to talk about what made Virginia. Can you hear me now? So I need to be this close to the microphone? Is that good for everybody?
Turn it up.
Where?
No, that's it. You just need to be a little bit closer.
Just close to it.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I'm used to moving around the classroom, so feel free to, if you put your hand up back there, I promise I will get back to the mic. All right, how many of you are from Virginia? Okay. So we have, people who are familiar with some of the big stories of Virginia, I'm guessing, and people who probably have some inkling of this long history with tobacco that is absolutely integral to Virginia's history. Does anybody know when Europeans started being curious about using tobacco? Does anyone know that? 16th century, I hear a few people saying. 17th century, okay. He did take some, right, at the very end of the 16th century, yes, back to the Elizabethan court, yes. How about the rest of Europe? Any guesses on who introduced tobacco to Europe? It was actually before then. It's a New World crop. So it postdates Columbus. The first European documentation of tobacco is from Columbus's voyages to the New World. And yeah, so then the Portuguese bring tobacco back. The stories of it came back with Columbus's crew. But it's really the Portuguese who introduce it to Africa and then to Europe. And many Europeans read about it in herbals long before they ever saw it, smelled it, or smoked it themselves. And this is among the earliest drawings of it in a European herbal. This is from 1560. And this is Jean Nicote, where the word nicotine comes from, who was the French ambassador to the Portuguese court, and began to popularize this and brought some to the French court from Portugal. And what happened was that the elites, people who had access to the royal court, started using tobacco, or at least illustrating it. It's a very succulent plant to Europeans. It's very exotic looking to Europeans. So they're very curious about it. It's also quite a beautiful plant. Everyone is highly suspicious of it because you smoke it. And Europeans are trying to figure out in these early days of understanding tobacco what it is. How does it fit into their system of medicine? What is it? And the going theory at the time had to do with balancing the four humors of the body, the moist, the dry, the hot, and the cold. And you know, tobacco smoke is both hot and it's dry. So what does that do? But it would make people cough. It didn't smell very good to most people. So people were highly suspicious of it. And in fact, most religious authorities and most court authorities, their initial impulse was to ban it in some form. And this is almost the global story, that the initial reaction to tobacco is to ban it. And then what do you think happens after people try to ban something that's new and kind of exciting? It becomes more popular, and when it becomes more popular, what can you do with it? Tax it. You can make money from it, right? So that's where this story begins, right? With its introduction to the European court and the authorities figuring out we can make money from this if we can control it. So I have one more of the early, the pre-Virginia tobacco illustrations here. And can you hear me if I walk with the microphone too? Okay. This is the arms of the tobacconists. This is from London in 1630. And King James in 1604, before the Virginia Company lands in Jamestown in 1607, King James wrote something called the Counterblast to Tobacco, which was his screed against this noxious weed. But then by the end of the 1610s, he is setting up all these regulations for which guilds are going to have part of it. Regulations for pipe makers, regulations for inspectors, regulations for seals to be made to certify that tobacco is from one of the British areas. And then laws that tobacco will come from Virginia, that it cannot be grown in Great Britain or in England. All the apparatus to move along with tobacco gets put in place in between about 1607 and 1620, when it looks like it's going to be what's going to bring money in from England's colonies. So King James turns around after that counterblast in 1604 with all these ways that the British, the English are going to make money off tobacco. And then we get this association of tobacco with the colony of Virginia. And it's a little confused at first because tobacco is exotic to Europeans. So these images are very often a mixture of African images as well as Native American images. And Native American, both North American natives and South American natives. And the images from in early 17th century English tobacco shops are very often have Roman African motifs, because it is this association with how the English are thinking about Africa at the time. So we have this person with very African features, but this skirt made of tobacco leaves and an almost Native American looking headdress, and then this best Virginia here on this hogshead of tobacco, and smoking this European pipe. This is an English tobacco pipe. So we have this sort of wonderful confusion of all these different images rolled into what tobacco is. Let me go to the next slide, and then I have some show and tell here. But so this is your next quiz here. For how many years is tobacco Virginia's biggest export? All right, I have 250 in the back. Do I hear 300? Do I hear 350? Do I hear 400? Will anybody give me 400? All right. From 1614 until 2006, almost 400 years, tobacco is Virginia's biggest export. Virginia is never a big tobacco, never a big cotton exporter. There is some, actually probably more cotton grown now on land that's owned by German industrial agriculture companies than ever, and it was not a colonial crop in Virginia until about the time of the Revolution. Tobacco was it. Any guesses on what replaced it in 2006?
Is that export out of
It's both. It's first out of the colony and then out of the state. Probably out of the country. Probably out of the country. And it's exported as an agricultural good during the colonial period, but once we hit the 19th and then definitely the 20th century, it's exported as a manufactured good. So if you look up just agricultural tables, it is not the largest agricultural export in, say, 1960. But in terms of money, it is the largest export, but it's a manufactured good by the time it leaves Philip Morris in Richmond, Virginia. So, any guesses on what replaced it in 2006? No. It's not an agricultural crop. It's something else. No, but you're... No? No? Computer chips. Computer chips, software, things to do with it. Yeah. So, right, there we go. From the 17th century until the early 21st century, you know, and then we leap right into computers, right? We go from hoe and stick agriculture right to computers here. All right, and I will stop here just a moment. I brought some clay tobacco pipes. These are all reproductions, and they are just as valuable to me in pieces as they are whole. So pass these around and touch them. And I have four. This is a reproduction of the earliest tiny European clay tobacco pipes that they find at Jamestown. I'm going to leave this one taped to the card. But if you look closely at it, it's got these wonderful little fleur-de-lis and other crossets and other little lozenges and symbols. And Robert Cotton, who was at Jamestown by 1609, was making these white clay tobacco pipes, which is very interesting because it's before Virginia starts exporting the tobacco that will make it wealthy. So this is very interesting that they bring someone here who's making tobacco pipes. But at Jamestown, in the recent excavations, they found pieces of the kiln that he used, pieces of the sager, which is a form that holds things in the kiln so they don't fall apart, and a lot of pieces of these pipes. So I'll just pass these around. So that's the earliest one. Yeah, that's the actual size. The earliest pipes had very, very tiny bowls because tobacco was very expensive. And then the bowls, you know what, I'll put this in the holder and hold these up with two hands. I'm a material culture person, so I need things to teach with. And then I'll pass these two, which are probably the more familiar form of white clay tobacco pipes. And you can see the bowls on these are much larger than that early 17th century replica. They have long stems because the stems get hot. And this is one of the things about tobacco. You have to, a basic pipe has a bowl to hold the tobacco and then a stem to draw the air across the tobacco into the smoker's mouth. And so they took different forms. These are incredibly useful to archaeologists because what we find are pieces of these stems, most of them about an inch or so long, and we can actually use the diameter of the bore holes to date archaeological sites, particularly if we find lots of these. The statistical patterns of these are one of the keys to life in the 18th and the 17th century. So I'll pass these around. And then I have one more that will come around, which is a replica of a 19th century Pamplin pipe, what's called a Pamplin pipe from Pamplin, Virginia, which is an example of a very inexpensively made, it's slightly reddish clay, it's not the fine white ball clay of these gentlemen's pipes, reddish clay, and the smoker would get a reed to put on this. So you can keep the pipe and use it over and over and throw away the reed and get a new one as you need one. And these were very inexpensive. They were also, another name for them was penny pipes. And the Pamplin Park, the Pamplin site down in Pamplin, Virginia has one of these kilns. It's administered by the Park Service. And they're the remnants of these from the mid to late 19th century down there. But you can find replicas of these, particularly in Civil War shops and other museum shops. And they take lots of different forms. So these are better than any pictures I could get of these kind of pipes. So I brought them to show you. All right, so one of the most important things about tobacco is that it is labor intensive. It was described early on as a 13-month crop in a 12-month year. So the cycle, the agricultural cycle for tobacco, begins before the last crop has even left the planter's realm. So they overlap. So this is a very intensive labor pattern. And tobacco, unlike other English crops, is done with a hoe. England considers civilized land something that is hoed, something that is plowed, something that has been worked in large field patterns. Tobacco is not that. And this was very hard for the early English settlers to get around, this idea of what cultivation and what actual ownership of the land and civilization looks like. Because when the Indians cultivated tobacco, and then the Virginians, the English learned it from the Indians, you can cultivate tobacco with a stick. You don't need anything more sophisticated than a stick. You have to start the seed. The seed is very tiny. A planter can hold an entire year's fortune in his hand. The seeds are that tiny. And this is, you know, thousands of acres worth of seed in your hand. So it gets planted maybe in March, and this is one of these, there are a couple times a year when the planter's judgment and skill is called into question because the entire year's fortune can disappear. So maybe in March, the planter, if the ground is warm enough and he thinks it's okay, the planter takes the seed and has his workers, sometimes they're his family, sometimes they're slaves, sometimes they're indentured servant, make raised beds, usually near a barn or near a fence line or near a tree line to give them some kind of buffer from wind and little encapsulate the temperature, and a raised bed to keep the ground from freezing. They have the workers burn across the beds. They may even pile it with brush to sterilize the soil. And then the tobacco seed is mixed with some kind of ash, something to carry it into the ground. And it's broadcast across the ground of these beds and then tamped very lightly into the ground with the hands or with even with bare feet. And then a couple months later, when these seedlings are about 12 inches high, the description is every walking member of the labor force. Every walking member. So that includes women, that includes children who could handle a tender seedling of a plant, that includes old folks who could still move, and that includes both white servants, that includes slaves, that might include the entire planter's family depending on their social rank. Every walking member of the labor force plants these seedlings from this nursery bed to the fields that are put into hills with hoes. And sometimes planters will use a plow just to cross-mark the fields to make rows. But generally, the entire process can be done with a hoe. And in Virginia, we get different kinds of hoes. And they're a little hard to see here. But we've got a narrow hoe, a broad hoe, a grubbing hoe, which is for getting the weeds out and clearing new fields. And then there's some other common agricultural tools here, a narrow spade, and a narrow axe. But these hoes, the narrow one, which is for planting, the broad hoe, which is for weeding, and to make hills, mounds of dirt, and then these seedlings are put into them. Then, while the seedlings are growing, and this is completely different from something like wheat, where you put it in the ground and you really don't need to do anything to it until you harvest it. But while these plants are growing, every single plant, once they're about this high, needs to be inspected at least weekly for tobacco hornworms, which are these big, succulent green worms. And there are descriptions of people who did field work regularly of letting their thumbnails grow long and thick to pop the heads off the worms as they went through the fields. But these worms have to come off the leaves. The plants are topped when they start sending out shoots at the top to make flowers. The planter has the top taken off because it forces growth at the larger leaves, because what they want to send back to England is these large leaves from the bottom of the plant. And then suckers, new little leaf sprouts that are that the plant is sending off on the stem are peeled off. Because ideally what the planter wants is a dozen to two dozen really big leaves from the base of the plant. And then in the fall, late summer, early fall, the planter has to decide when this crop has to come in. And it is picked leaf by leaf in the colonial period. Until the 19th century, when there's a different variety of tobacco that gets cut by the plant and the whole plant is hung to dry, tobacco is picked leaf by leaf. So you can send your workforce through the field every day and they pick the leaves that are ripe and the next day they go back. So you might have a planter like Robert King Carter has 3,000 plants. And there might be someone touching those plants every single day during that harvesting season. So this is a very labor-intensive crop, and this is one of the things that makes Virginia what it is in the colonial period, is the demand of tobacco. And then, okay, they bring that tobacco in from the field, they hang it on sticks in barns to dry, and I'll show you some pictures of that in a moment. When it's dry enough, the right moisture content, it has to be dry but not too dry, the large veins are stripped out of the leaves. And this is described as skilled labor. This is not unskilled labor. Someone who knows tobacco leaves has to do this stripping. It's very often the work of slave women and who do it every single year and who know these plants. But the large veins are stripped out of the leaves, and then the leaves are packed in hogsheads, which are 1,000-pound barrels, and pressed into these hogsheads before they go to an inspection station and put on a ship and that might be the next April. And remember, this seed bed went in March the year before, right? So in April, they might be going on a ship and actually heading across the Atlantic. So the next year's crop has already been started. And so it's a crop that needs an awful lot of attention. And there's these two moments, that putting it into the field and then that moment when you're taking it out of the field when the entire crop can be lost, in a day or two in a really bad storm. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. This is a great picture. This is a sketch by Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who traveled through the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century. But he gives us this marvelous picture. And you can see here, this field, this is a tobacco field that's being stripped of tree growth. But there's already going to be tobacco growing in this. This does not look like a cultivated, civilized field, right? If you got off a boat from anywhere in Europe, you wouldn't say, this is where someone is a successful planter, and yet this is what Virginia becomes. The Indians girdled the trees so that they would die, but they planted their crops among them for years before those stumps could be grubbed out. And then you can see these two slave women working with hoes. These stumps are being burnt out, and then we've got our overseer standing here watching them, and he's smoking his pipe while they work. But this is a great image of what many fields in Virginia would have looked like. And tobacco is also uses up land after a few years, and so planters who wanted to be successful always had land that's being cleared. So if there was any downtime in that tobacco cycle that I already discussed, the workers were out there clearing these trees, using the wood to make these Virginia fences. In fact, there's a lovely 18th century description of someone being drunk as being making Virginia fences because they're walking like this. So the labor is more important than making fine board fences or other things. The apparatus of tobacco, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit fuzzy, requires barns for drying. Occasionally, there are different kinds of drying racks, but in Virginia, we have barns, I have some more images of barns here. There we go. This is from Henricus Historical Park in Chester, Virginia. But you can see the tobacco that's brought into these barns. And barns are very specialized. Barns are different in every tobacco-growing region, depending on what kind of tobacco they're growing. And in Virginia, again, it gets hung leaf by leaf on these little sticks that get hung on tier poles. And if you go in an old barn, if you can find an early barn, and it's missing joists between every other rafter pair, if it looks like someone took out every other joist, it's a tobacco barn, because they leave that space in there to hang the tobacco all the way through the barn. And then and in Virginia, the sheathing is fairly tight, but there's some air that passes through, and there are small doors on the ends for letting air in and out, depending on to get the right humidity of the crop as it's drying. But this is a good interior showing just a little bit of tobacco in there. Maryland barns are different. Connecticut shade-grown barns are different. Bright leaf tobacco barns in the what's now called the Old Belt in Virginia, North Carolina are different. So they change with every variety of tobacco. This labor system that affected the the demands of tobacco that affected the labor system are also attributed to affecting how people built their houses. And there's something called the Virginia house, which is a direct product of the demands of tobacco on the calendar of a plantation. And in the Virginia house, and this is a 17th century house type, and it is called a Virginia house even when they're built in Maryland or other colonies, because it refers to the framing system of the house. And what this is a labor-saving way of putting up a house quickly, because you need your labor in the field. You don't need it building fine houses early on, unless you have a lot of money, and then you're building some great brick mansion. But this is what most people are building. And I'll explain this to you. I have two more slides to do that here. But basically what happens, if you got off the boat from England and you were building a house in New England or even in the earliest part of Maryland, you would tie your roof rafters to your post and your plate right here. This would be a very complex joint that would tie this entire frame together. But in Virginia, the roof system is almost an entirely separate structural system that sits on bays that are down here. And this is probably because of the labors of the demands of tobacco. So this is a separate system. You can see that the red here is almost like a box that holds the main room of the house. And then the rafters are riding out here instead of being tied into the posts. So it's almost as if you could take off the rafters. I mean, you can't, of course, because it's too big. But it's almost as if you could, and then the box would stay there separate from that. And this has been attributed to the demands of the tobacco labor, because you can put up a house like this pretty quickly, and you can also replace parts of it pretty quickly. And again, it's called a Virginia house, even if it's a house type, a framing system. So I'm going to talk now for a minute about how tobacco affected land, society, and political power, which of course are all tied together in Virginia. Tobacco is extractive of land. It uses up the nutrients in soil, and so someone can only plant the same piece of land for 3 years for a really, really great crop, maybe 6 years, and the crop is diminishing in value. The concept of rotating crops, of planting different things, is not yet something that people are attached to. And so the idea is, and particularly with people with a lot of money in this period in Virginia, is that you just own enough land to turn it over, which is why, and this is also very interesting, that the seat of power in Virginia in the 17th century is down here around the James River. But by the very early 18th century, that seat of power has moved to where the best tobacco is coming from, which is up here around the Potomac River region. And what I mean by power is this is where the Burgesses, who are going to the House of Burgesses in the Virginia capital of Jamestown and in Williamsburg, the people who are making the best laws or having the most influence in laws, who are on the most powerful committees in the House of Burgesses, that sort of center of power moves from this group of men to this group of men. And then where do you think it moves next by the middle of the 18th century? It doesn't move to Richmond, no. It really moves right down here to the Piedmont, right? And the slave trade moves upriver to about Richmond, is where, you know, is sort of the embarkation point between this. But you can almost map the power of Virginia moving with where people are buying land, and it goes from here to here to over here before the Revolution. And we see this in things like, you know, sometimes we get these wonderful documents left to us. This is a survey that Thomas Jefferson did. In fact, this is the Shadwell lands. And he made this survey in 1799 when he's making a lease with an overseer, and he's dividing up the lands because he wants a system of crop rotation. And he has already written for about a dozen years, he's already writing about how Virginians shouldn't plant tobacco anymore because it destroys the soil and it's not taking good stewardship of the earth. But in fact, if we look closely at this survey that Thomas Jefferson himself drew in 1799, tobacco grounds right here, and we've got a tobacco barn and there's another tobacco barn, and he's still growing tobacco there. And in fact, there's a letter that he writes to one of his overseers about this piece of land, because the slaves have also planted some tobacco, and he's suspicious of this. And he said, you know, I told them not to plant tobacco there because then I don't know what's theirs and what is my own. So even though publicly he's decrying tobacco, you know, when we look closely at these documents, you know, here it is. This is the cartouche from the 1751 Fry Jefferson map of Virginia, and that Jefferson is Peter Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson's father, whose house I write about in my book, and Joshua Fry, who was a professor of mathematics at the College of William and Mary, and they were asked to draw this map of Virginia. And this cartouche, which was made in a London print shop, this was not drawn here in Virginia, but this really encapsulates all that Virginia was by the middle of the 18th century. And you can see here a wharf site. I mean, there were no wharf, there were no inspection stations that looked like this in 18th century Virginia. No one was building ashlar masonry temples here on their docks. But we've got a wharf, we've got ships being loaded for international trade, we've got hogsheads of tobacco being handled by male slaves, and then we've got our merchants here, sort of making deals. We've got our planter sitting down, very well dressed. He's not doing any work there. And here is another slave who's bringing him on probably a silver tray, possibly it's pewter, but you know, who's bringing him some kind of you know, refreshing beverage in stemware while he sits there. So this is Virginia, and this is also the English perception of Virginia in the middle of the 18th century. And you know, and here's some tobacco spilling out. But this is Virginia's. It's the social power, it's the political power, and it is the economic engine of Virginia. And on the eve of the Revolution, and this is important to remind people, but on the eve of the American Revolution, 1 in 5 people living in North America is a Virginian. Virginia is Great Britain's largest North American colony. You know, we tend to forget that after, you know, what happened in the 1860s. We tend to forget how powerful Virginia was in the period of the Revolution. And it was all because of tobacco. Tobacco, of course, also had its ills. And we, you know, this is a tavern scene, and it's a little fuzzy there, but, you know, you can see these, and these are all gentlemen, of course, you know, and this guy's falling out of his chair, this guy's, you know, trying to light his pipe, and some of the ash is falling down, this guy's spilling the bottles, this guy's also sort of, you know, about to fall on the ground himself. There's a very dissolute woman back here smoking, and we wonder what she's doing there. You know, so this is the other side of tobacco consumption and what tobacco has done for Virginia culture and for the English counterparts on the other side of the Atlantic. And I'll move for a moment to all important to transportation, because that is also a very important part of how tobacco affected Virginia, and transportation is also a key here. And this is a very fine map drawn by our own Rick Britton. But tobacco, these hogsheads, these large barrels that are made, mostly made here in Virginia, take the tobacco overseas, weigh about 1,000 pounds a piece. That's the ideal weight for them. You know, when you read the actual bills of lading, they're anywhere from, you know, 850 pounds to 1,100 pounds, and, you know, because they record the exact weight. But they're massive. They travel by ship. To England, to Liverpool, to various ports in England, where very often then the tobacco gets manufactured and either sent back across the Atlantic or sent into European markets. You know, when the French are using lots of tobacco, Virginians are getting very rich, and so are their intermediaries in Great Britain. So when tobacco is coming out of Williamsburg, along the York River, the James River, the biggest planters own these wharves, and ocean-going vessels can pull right up. In fact, when you go to Shirley on that field trip that Rick was talking about, that's exactly the kind of place, that's exactly the kind of planter that has a wharf for ocean-going vessels that are taking tobacco. And what that means is the best land, the best seats, the people with political power have these waterside estates where they can control that transportation. So any small planters, if you don't own enough land, and if you're not powerful enough to own land on one of these waterways, then you're probably selling your tobacco to one of these large planters at a place like Shirley Plantation, and it's getting put in with his tobacco to get put on one of these ships. So maybe if you have a whole hogshead, maybe you get a note for your hogshead. And if you only have half a hogshead, then you sell that planter your tobacco, and he mixes it with someone else's. So these powerful seats are also the places where the transportation and the economic exchanges are taking place. Well, as the need for land moves inland above the fall line, and the fall line runs through Petersburg, Richmond, Fredericksburg, that's the largest place that a deep water vessel can get before there are waterfalls. It's a geologic break in Virginia between the tidewater and what's west of there. So once tobacco production moves above the fall line, you need a different transportation system. And Virginians figure out how to do that. This map is showing us how the Jeffersons here in Albemarle County, or here at Shadwell, are getting their tobacco down to ocean-going vessels. And they're going, they have the wherewithal to pick what warehouses they're going to. Not everybody has that option. The Jeffersons do. And they're sending their tobacco up here to the South Anna River, where it's going through Hanover County and down the York River. Or they're sending it down here to Westham and to Shaco's, which are in what's now Richmond, which is one of these tobacco inspection seats, because it's a place where your modes of transportation change. So these become these economic centers. And so the Jeffersons can choose depending on who's trading the best for tobacco. And then, of course, from there, it goes out to the Atlantic. Virginians figure out all sorts of ways to get their tobacco along the not very good roads in Virginia. Let me see if this image shows up better. That's not very good, but I'll try to explain it. Upriver on the James, people invent something called bateaux, which are flat-bottomed boats that can take 5 to 9 hogsheads of tobacco. And these are pulled downriver to one of these inspection stations where then they're put on a deep water vessel. The Reverend Robert Rose, who lived in what's now Amelia County, but it was Albemarle County at the time, wrote about these. And there still is a bateau festival today that meets in, it comes through Scottsville in June. Is that when it comes through? Some June, July? Which is recalling these days of these tobacco boats carrying hogsheads of tobacco down the river. Now, if the water is low, or if you're not near enough to the water, you figure out a way. Instead of putting tobacco, the hogsheads on wagons, you turn them on their side and you put hames around them. You put a collaring system around it, and sometimes bands, extra bands around the hogshead, and you hook your team of draft animals to it, and you roll it to the next place where you can put it on a deep water vessel. And so the roller men are part of, and they're sort of an itinerant a group of people who travel around Virginia getting paid to roll tobacco. And so that's how the tobacco gets from small farms or from inland farms to one of these water systems. But these transportation systems are absolutely integral to this story. And they're also quite interesting. And lastly, I'm going to talk about what tobacco did to Virginia's cultural system. There's a theory that historians use to talk about large-scale agricultural production. Actually, I'll stop there just a moment, but which is called staple crop theory. And the idea is that when a large area, or even a small area in sort of a micro-sized study, is so invested in a single product that it controls everything about the cultural systems. And we've already talked about the labor system and political power and the transportation systems. But with tobacco, these families who are investing in tobacco, they don't travel when it's one of these periods of the year when the tobacco, when someone there has to be at home to make the decision about when those seedlings go into the field or when those leaves have to start coming into the barn to dry. And so you see the social calendar of the year changing depending on when what the demands of that crop are. And in Virginia, the social calendar of the elite and hence the social activities of the non-elite are very much tied to that agricultural cycle of tobacco. So the big assemblies that would happen in Williamsburg or then later other cultural centers happen once that tobacco is in, probably either in the hogsheads or at least in the barns drying, but not at any point when it's in one of these more precarious states. These same studies have been done of sugar in the Sugar Islands, of cotton, certainly in the Deep South in the early 19th century, and some other places. And it's a very useful tool for understanding that it's not just the people who are out there doing the farm labor who are affected by tobacco. It affects the entire society. And certainly that's the case in Virginia well past the time of the Revolution. Tobacco also, of course, affects the cultural artifacts. Now, I've passed around the white clay pipes, which are ubiquitous on colonial Virginia sites, but we also find many other kinds of apparatus for smoking tobacco. In South America, tobacco is most often, in the colonial period, is most often rolled into something resembling a cigar, and then cigar manufactories show up in mostly in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies. So, Cuba is manufacturing cigars long before, it becomes, the banned substance of the 20th century. And other Spanish outposts in the New World are manufacturing cigars. But in Virginia, it's smoking tobacco by pipe, which is really prevails in certainly in the 17th and 18th century and well into the 19th century. And then we can start talking a little bit about snuff and chewing tobacco. Chewing tobacco is an American invention. It's just a moister version of snuff. But this is a stone pipe that was found on a slave quarter site, actually here in Alamo County, at the Shadwell site. But a slave, an enslaved person who had access to these nice clay pipes that we were passing around, decided that he, maybe this was his hobby, maybe he just wanted some other way to smoke his tobacco, but he was trying to make a pipe out of this piece of Candler phyllite, which is related to slate, and so it broke apart before he could finish it. This is a pipe, a small fragment of a pipe made from steatite or soapstone. And we find a lot of these on Native American sites, but this one's actually from Mulberry Row right here at Monticello. And so we find these variations. And again, what you need is a bowl and then some a stem to draw the air across the bowl. And that's the only two things you need to have a pipe. In fact, at Jamestown, in the early fort excavations, they found a brick. Someone was trying to smoke a brick, which is very funny. Certainly, there is this association with Native Americans and tobacco, but that moves pretty quickly from being a Native activity to being associated with Virginia. And I showed you that tobacco advertising, that tobacco paper early on, you know, that slave standing there with the Virginia tobacco. And, you know, so it moves very quickly to being this association with colonial Virginia, with Englishmen, with enslaved laborers, and with sort of New World exoticism, but no longer Indian until these become sort of advertising icons in the 19th century again. But almost any picture of a Native American you see, and this is done by Joshua Reynolds in London in the 1760s, is going to be holding a tobacco pipe somewhere. And very often, they're European clay tobacco pipes and not Native American, not Native-made tobacco pipes. And there are forms of those that show up, but Native Americans are almost always pictured with tobacco pipes. Later in the 19th century, we also see this association of different kinds of tobacco pipes with different ethnicities. And this is an 1867 painting called American Citizens, or To the Poles. And we've got this presumably Irish immigrant, this figure that's supposed to represent an Irish immigrant. And he's got this little tiny, almost corncobbish pipe, and he's holding his little shillelagh here. And then we've got this German with this curvy meerschaum pipe, you know, this very old world looking pipe here. And then we've got our newly new voter here, our African American, who's got a fragment of a pipe in his hand. So this association with different kinds of smoking materials that are not part of this elite apparatus as the ones we were passing around here. We also, there are not very many images of women smoking, but occasionally, and there are references that some slave women smoked. There are references that a lot of white women smoked. In fact, there are a number of 17th century burials from Maryland of indentured servants and both white and black, and evidence that the men and the women in these laboring groups in Maryland were smoking. But there are very few images of women smoking. But this is one. This is freed slaves leaving the South after the Civil War, and this woman here is smoking a pipe. I can't tell what kind it is in this sketch. But we do have evidence from some sites that some women do smoke. But by and large, it tends to be a male activity. So again, you know, we come from this mysterious exotic plant that Europeans are fascinated with and a little bit suspicious of, to this thing that absolutely defines Virginia culture. And really, I love this cartouche of the Fry Jefferson map because it sums it all up. You know, we've got international trade, we've got slave labor, we've got, you know, a few of these middlemen, but not too many, these grandees who expect to be waited on, and, you know, the social ritual enhanced by material culture, you know, all wrapped up in that cartouche. And this association with tobacco is so important to the creation of the new United States. Does anybody know where these drawings are from, what these are for? Anybody know? They're columns. They're capitals for columns. These are Latrobe's. Benjamin Henry Latrobe drew these. And this is a sketch that he sent to Thomas Jefferson in 1819. But what they were doing is using the familiar architecture of the classical world, but rendering it in important New World symbols. So Latrobe invented this tobacco leaf capital, and this is in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. It's still there. There's a whole room of them. But the tobacco leaf and tobacco flower capital, this is a magnolia leaf capital, and there's also corn cob capitals. But these New World plants that were important to this creation of the identity of a new nation. But tobacco was that important. And really, it's into the mid-20th century when the U.S. government was still paying its architects to design spittoons to go in important public buildings. We don't do that anymore. But so just to, I just have a couple things that kind of, you know, bring us from that, you know, that sort of creation of the United States to kind of, you know, ease us into the more recent story of tobacco. As I said, you know, and there are people who go around and photograph old tobacco barns, and they're marvelous because every single, they're different depending on what variety of tobacco is being grown. But this is a different variety of Virginia tobacco. This is a Maryland tobacco barn with these long vertical vents on the side, because Maryland tobacco is different. It's dried differently. They like a different humidity. And so that's very different. And they also like to be able to drive their wagons right into these barns. In Virginia, they don't do that. Virginia barns are only for drying the tobacco. And it's people moving around that building, hanging the tobacco up. In 1839, a new way of drying tobacco is discovered in Caswell County, North Carolina, and that's the bright leaf tobacco. And bright leaf grows in the very particular, it actually was soil that was considered not very good until bright leaf tobacco was discovered. There's a belt that runs along the North Carolina-Virginia border, so it includes Mecklenburg County and along South Boston, Virginia, and down into Caswell County through Danville, Virginia, and down into North Carolina. And this is called the Bright Leaf Belt. And they dry their tobacco completely differently. And the story goes that a slave was tending the fire in 1839, and they had these barns that they would have a small flue in them to keep the dry air passing through the tobacco and to dry it more quickly. And it was raining, and the fire was going out, so he threw all this wood in there, and the burst of heat caused a chemical reaction in the leaf that made it dry this very bright yellow. And it turns out that this became very popular, and it's still an ingredient in cigarettes today. I mean, this is a very important, this bright leaf tobacco is mixed with the burley tobacco that's grown in other parts of Virginia. But these drying barns have these flues because they have these fireplaces built into the side of them, and then by the mid 20th century, they become electrified. So you can still see these, and very often they're in pairs. In fact, these are in Mecklenburg County. I just took this a couple years ago, and you can see the power lines here for the electricity to go in to run the dryers. But this is a different kind of tobacco, a slightly different landscape, which is one of the marvelous things about studying it. And there's some tobacco in the field. This too is down in Mecklenburg County. You can see tobacco growing in Williamsburg. If you go to Colonial Williamsburg today, you can see in Yorktown at the Yorktown Victory Center. But then you have to start going further south. You have to go to South Sutton, Virginia if you want to see it in the field. They're about 4 or 5 feet high. You know, because they're topped, they would sprout flowers at the top if you let them. But if you want to force the growth to the leaves, then that's about what they are. The Southwest is still very invested in tobacco. And now, if you see tobacco growing, that farmer has a contract with one of the big tobacco companies. Virginia, North Carolina had auction systems. You know, after the Revolution or during the Revolution. Tobacco stops leaving Virginia as an agricultural product and stops going to Scotland and England to be manufactured. And in the 19th century, we see the rise of different manufacturing plants here in the United States. The big change in tobacco is in the 1880s when a guy named Albert Bonsack invents the rolling machine, the cigarette rolling machine. And that is what makes the modern corporation. And in fact, these corporations became so powerful so quickly, beginning in the 1880s, that they were part of the Sherman antitrust settlements and then had to be disbanded in various capacities in 1911. But that rise of the big corporations, moving from small farms and small local manufactories and places, you know, if you went to Richmond in 1850, you would probably be able to buy 50 different kinds of cigarettes or tobacco, probably right at the place where it was being manufactured. And at the end of the 19th century, you're going to be buying it from American Tobacco or from Philip Morris, maybe a few others. But you see these large international corporations form then. Yes?
How did tobacco move to the Middle East?
Tobacco actually moved to the Middle East through Africa first. And this is one of those interesting things about tobacco, is that when the Portuguese introduced it to Africa in the 15th century, it is one of the things that is not prohibited in the Quran. And so, you know, it's not alcohol, it's not on the list of drugs that anyone knows, because it's a New World plant. And so it moves into the Middle East well before Europeans are embracing tobacco. And then actually Turkish tobacco, which, you know, of course is in cigarettes like Camel cigarettes, you know, these exotic Eastern tobaccos, actually has a little tiny leaf compared to these large burly leaves that we have here in Virginia, and they still make a lot of tobacco and sell it to these big international corporations, of course. But yeah, no, it's there. And there's some idea, because tobacco is also moving out of South America into Japan about the same time it's moving into Africa in the 15th century. So there's some idea that it moves across India and probably meets in Persia, perhaps from both sides at once. That, you know, we tend to think of culture kind of moving around the globe westward, but tobacco also moves the other direction. Tobacco comes from Mesoamerica, so it comes from south, you know, of here. But by probably the first century AD, tobacco has moved through almost all parts of America, South America and North America. There's archaeological evidence that tobacco is being used. It's a variety that we call tobacco rusticum, and there are slight variations on it. But it's not a very flavorful tobacco. And then, you know, the famous story, of course, is that John Rolfe in 1612, you know, the struggling Jamestown colony, you know, and they have the tobacco rusticum. They're getting it from the Native Americans. But John Rolfe is in the West Indies, and he brings back the sweet-scented Orinoco tobacco, and he plants it. And all of a sudden, Virginia has found its crop. So in 1614... that's the first big crop that makes money for Virginia. And then the story of the next quarter century is boomtown for Virginia. And everyone's growing tobacco. And it's, you know, that amazing rise. But, yeah, they're growing. You know, there's some evidence of other ritual smoking. But tobacco is certainly, you know, well into all parts of North America by the first, if not the third century. The Native Americans, you know, one of the ideas is that they wouldn't have made this separation between ritual and everyday life. So something like use of tobacco is medicinal and ritual and enriching and leisure all at once. There are rituals, for instance, the Calumet ritual, the peace pipe ritual that the English learn, that, or the Europeans in general in North America learn that they have to use when they meet with Indians. And in fact, the Virginia government would send treaties to meet with various Indians, with the Iroquois, with the Cherokee, and they talk about, you know, they smoke pipes when they meet. They smoke, you know, they don't always say peace pipe. You know, we smoke a pipe of tobacco. In the 18th century, the Virginians develop a trade good called a pipe tomahawk, because the Indians, you know, have tomahawks they carry. And they've figured out that, you know, the handle of the tomahawk is a very nice stem, and they can make not the business end of the tomahawk, but the other side, into a bowl and for smoking. And actually, a lot of English blacksmiths are making these as trade goods that are then going into the Native American communities. And so this is a very curious 18th century artifact, because is it Native American culturally? It is in many ways, but it's made by English blacksmiths in many cases. And it's one of these things that, you know, the Native Americans use against each other and use against various Europeans, depending on, you know, which war we're talking about. So it has ritual applications. And in many, for instance, in the Oneida, the Five Nations of the Iroquois, there's evidence of when those five nations became acting as the five nations based on when they were using tobacco in the same way among all five of them. It's hidden in the archaeological record as to when there's this sort of, you know, concerted use of smoking material. So, you know, it varies, but it's absolutely there. And, you know, there's a discussion going on whether whether we should be talking about it as ritual at all, or whether it's a more sort of everyday life activity. So, this is a great question. This question was, you know, what happens to this land that is left, you know, after a couple years of crop and that planter has moved on. A lot of it really is just left. And this is, you know, one of the things that happens to Tidewater, Virginia, when political power and economic power moves, and then particularly after the Revolution, when the capital of Virginia moves from Williamsburg to Richmond. And, you know, all these grand seats of Tidewater, Virginia, are left with land that's not very good for much until you get chemical fertilizers, you know, until you start getting chemical fertilizers and you can start planting all different things. But there's a lot of land that reportedly is just sitting there. It gets scrubby and things grow up and you get second growth. And then there's debate on, you know, when it's right. And there's lots of treatises written about tobacco in the 18th century. About when, you know, when you can go back to this land and ways you can improve it. But there, you know, by all reports, there's a lot of land that's just sitting there, and which is why a lot of, you know, Virginia, people who settled Illinois when the old Northwest was being settled, you know, the first sort of movement from the 13 original colonies into what was called the old Northwest then, Illinois, you know, I think something like 45% of the people who went to Illinois were from Virginia, and it's because they needed land, you know, and a lot of them are, you know, second sons, and in fact, the Carter's Grove, the Burles, who owned Carter's Grove outside of Williamsburg, Virginia, you know, they moved to Page County, up outside of Winchester, because their land really isn't producing anything in Tidewater anymore. And so the whole family, you know, you move, if you go up to Page County, Virginia, there, you know, it's almost a map of early Tidewater families when you go through the cemeteries up there, because there's just this movement out of there. You know, so there's these great seats, and you're going to see a couple on this field trip. But you know, the sort of remnants of you know, these glory days of when tobacco was really bringing in the bucks for them.
Well, Susan, thank you so much. You're welcome.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.